attributable to human error.
Hello and welcome to Fresh Air. I'm Joe.
I'm Dave.
I'm Rodan.
I'm Chris.
And I'm Andy.
And tonight we continue episode 2, where we're looking at various moral theories. Now, you might remember last week we examined a few different moral theories in a high-level way. We looked at consequentialist, deontological, virtue-based, and moral subjectivism. So we're now going to be taking a step further and looking into more detail at these moral theories. We're going to start by looking at consequentialist moral theories. Now, if you don't remember, consequentialist moral theories is the consequences of the actions determine the morality. The first one we're going to cover is hedonism. Andy, Chris, what's your opinion on what hedonism is?
By my very limited understanding of it, it's essentially the seeking of pleasure.
I would say, yeah, probably the same thing. Doing what makes you feel feel good, I suppose. I suppose it's quite, is it selfish, I suppose?
Unfortunately, quite a lot of my knowledge, in very large air quotes, on this comes purely from Futurama.
Hedonism by rules.
I mean, if I'm going to have to be reincarnated as a robot somehow in the future, then hedonism bot's definitely the way to go.
It does look like a lot of fun, doesn't it? Which so I suppose is the point.
So is that an accurate representation of what hedonism is?
It's sort of what it has become known as in the modern times. Originally, though, hedonism was a moral theory and a value theory. The value theory is that the only thing that is of any real value is pleasure and happiness. And from that, it's extended to moral theory, where the only actions that have any real value are actions that create pleasure or happiness. Not necessarily in a selfish way, like if you cause happiness for another person, that's a moral action. If you cause happiness for yourself, that's a moral action.
So what happens if you cause happiness for yourself, or you cause happiness for someone else at the detriment to yourself?
That's exactly what I was going to ask.
It's the overall amount of happiness that gets generated.
So that's kind of utilitarian then, isn't it?
Sort of, but that in utilitarianism, it's more the greatest amount of good for the greatest amount of people, rather than just the amount of pleasure that it creates or the amount of happiness that it creates.
So that relies on the ability of being able to quantify pleasure, then?
Yeah, basically. But you can sort of see the amount of happiness you've created from an action just from experiencing it.
I suppose there's also a way that you could scientifically measure it by doing brain scans and hormone levels.
Endorphins.
And those sorts of things, exactly. Aren't there different types of hedonism as well, though, Dave?
Yeah, there's classical hedonism and Epicurean hedonism.
So what's the difference between the two of those?
Epicurean hedonism is about moderation. It's about finding pleasure in the little things, so to speak, like having dinner with friends.
Podcasts never, with friends.
Yeah, basically, but never taking things too far, never allowing pleasure in one area to create sadness in another area. Whereas hedonism, it's all about instant gratification.
So would you say the Epicurean hedonism, where we were just having that example of happiness for someone else to the detriment to myself, might not actually fit into the Epicurean version?
It would, because you're still sort of creating happiness. How can I put it? If you're causing yourself harm rather than just a little bit of inconvenience, then it's probably not a moral action according to Epicurean hedonism. But like I say, it's a little different than just immediate gratification. It's kind of closer to virtue ethics in that it's about moderation, like I say, whereas regular hedonism is just about creating pleasure and creating happiness.
So it's the difference between having a chocolate bar here and there than having 10 chocolate bars in one go.
Yeah, basically. Because according to Epicurean hedonism, if you ate all the chocolate bars now, you might be happy now. But if you had them one a day, you'd have a little bit of pleasure each day.
Could it also be looked at with something like an addictive drug, where classical hedonism, you get the pleasure from it. Obviously, the addiction is a negative over time, so it wouldn't fit with Epicurean hedonism.
Yeah, whereas hedonism is basically enjoy yourself.
Live for the moment.
Yeah, live for the moment, basically. Eat now, for tomorrow we may die, kind of thing.
Was it also Epicurus who distinguished between the different kinds of pleasures, or was it someone else?
I'm not sure. I think he might have, but I know that John Mill did. He had higher and lower pleasures, where higher pleasures were pleasures of the intellect and lower pleasures were like sports and, you know, leisure activities and that kind of thing.
Sounds rather elitist.
Yeah, that's one of the criticisms. I mean, is there really a difference in the kind of pleasure between, say, reading a book and having a game of bowling?
I think the difference depends on the person.
Yeah, that's it. But it's not a greater pleasure, if you see what I mean.
It could be a different type of pleasure, though. I suppose if you're doing something very exertive, you will get a potentially a big rush of endorphins, and your whole body will feel different to perhaps something that is more just purely mentally stimulating, which you'll still feel in the enjoyment, but you might not necessarily have as much of a physical response.
Yeah, but it's more about, it is more intellectually elitist. It's sort of saying you can't ever get the same kind of pleasure from a Batman graphic novel than you would with reading Dostoevsky, and that reading the Batman comic is of very little value when it comes to happiness, whereas reading Dostoevsky is the greater value.
Clearly has been reading the wrong Batman comics.
I agree. But yeah, that's basically hedonism in a nutshell. It's happiness is the only pleasure, the only value, the only thing that's worth anything. Do you know what instrumental value and final value is?
No, please tell us.
Okay, instrumental value is what something has when we use it to get something else. So money has instrumental value because we can use it to obtain further things.
And yeah, there's no point in money unless you've got something to buy, is there?
Exactly. Whereas something like education can be valuable in and of itself. You don't necessarily need to have a further goal in mind when you study something. It could be just for the pleasure of learning that particular thing.
Yeah. Basically, when you buy a can of Coke because you're thirsty, the instrumental value of the Coke is that it's that it will quench your thirst. And when you buy a can of Coke because you like the taste of Coke, then that's basically the intrinsic value of the Coke.
So I suppose you could also apply that to money with people who just like being rich and never intend to actually spend any of it. It's basically just points on a scoreboard.
No, that's what we call a dick move.
Absolutely.
But according to hedonism, pleasure is the only thing that has final value. Everything we do to strive towards pleasure.
But we have to remember it's not necessarily personal pleasure, as most people would think it, where you think of the typical hedonist, you think someone who's just going out for their own pleasure, but the point of it is actually the higher weighted pleasure for someone.
It can't be for the detriment of the society that they're within.
Yeah, basically. And that's another thing that Epicurean hedonism promotes, is social structures and that kind of thing.
Yet distance from politics.
Yeah, he was kind of a recluse, wasn't he?
I think he just didn't get it, but that's just my opinion.
So, Martin, obviously we've covered off some of your preferences to various moral theories. We went into depth last week. How do you find hedonism fits in with how you see the world?
Well, I think pleasure does have some intrinsic value, and it can be very valuable. It can be less valuable to individuals. But I think that when we're talking morality, I think there's greater things we should take into account.
So, guys, what do you think the key problems you can see off the top of your head with hedonism are?
One that I can see, not with the Epicurean one, is that the instant pleasure that you get from hedonism might cause long-term negative effects.
The issue I'm finding with it is that if pleasure is the ultimate goal, is the main thing that is being valued, then what if it is agreed upon by society that a bad thing is pleasurable?
And there are a lot of people that demonstrate that.
Yeah, exactly. So, say, as an example, trophy hunting. If the wider society found pleasure in trophy hunting, then according to even Epicurean hedonism, wouldn't that then be a moral good?
Does that link back into the personhood? How much personhood do we give the trophy that you're hunting? How much harm is hunting that thing doing the environment overall?
Yeah, you could make an argument that it's being culled, but for trophy hunting, that isn't the reason, is it?
And there's also, what pleasure are you taking away from people who want to simply go on a safari?
That's a valid point.
But again, you've got to weight it. How much pleasure does one get out of killing that animal? About that's different to how much pleasure one gets out of just seeing them in a field.
But a lot of people will get to see it in a field as opposed to one person killing it.
That's a good point, yeah.
What about a situation like trophy hunting in an area where the animals have been raised just to be hunted?
Yeah, there's a program specifically for animals to be killed and they're never going to be in the wild, then that goes back to my initial problem with it, I suppose.
Yeah, that's it. Hedonism isn't a particularly good moral theory. Like Martijn says, pleasure and happiness has intrinsic value, and I think it is a necessary part of any moral theory in deciding what actions are good and bad, but I think hedonism is kind of shallow.
It's more a parameter than a kind of a first thought, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I agree. It's a nice, easy rule of thumb. You know, if I'm going to make somebody happy, then I'm probably doing something good for them. Or if I'm making myself happy without causing anybody else any harm, I'm probably doing something that's okay, but it's not good enough to create a big, robust moral theory.
Cool. That's really interesting. Are there any others that you can see off the top of your heads, guys?
Another problem I would see is going back to Chris's quantification problem. Because imagine I have two ice cream cones, one for myself, one for one random other person. I wouldn't know, let's say it's chocolate ice cream, and I have two friends with me. One loves chocolate ice cream, one absolutely hates it. Without asking them, I wouldn't be able to discern which choice I should make.
Yeah, so you're right. We're back to the quantification, because everybody isn't in a MRI machine. We can't measure everyone's hormone levels. We don't know everybody's tastes. Something like you mentioned there, we can just ask them. But as you say, it's not something that's easily quantifiable without having that initial conversation. We can't always perceive or predict what the consequence of the action is going to be until after it has actually happened.
Exactly. And imagine they both like chocolate ice cream, but one of them likes it just a smidge more.
We can take that kind of quantification to even more of an extreme as well. As opposed to measuring how much one person likes something versus how much somebody else likes it, we could go to an extreme of whether somebody likes something more than somebody else hates something. So if I really, really, really enjoy punching someone and they only kind of dislike it, well, then it's still more pleasure being made than taken away.
I like that.
one of the common criticisms.
A net gain of pleasure there.
Exactly.
This will kind of go back to the episode you guys recorded about the Matrix. Have you heard of something called the experience machine?
I have. When we were discussing thought problems before, it was one that I raised to you about possibly bringing up, but I don't think we discussed it.
Yeah, I don't think we discussed either. Okay, so the experience machine was created by Robert Nozick in the 70s. And it was a criticism of not so much the moral theory of hedonism, but the value theory of hedonism. Imagine you were offered to plug into a machine, and this machine can cater to every single pleasure you could ever dream of. You'll be plugged into this machine for the rest of your life. You can't come out, but you will experience nothing but pleasure for the rest of your life. Would you plug into this machine?
I would say most people do that to their phones nowadays.
Guilty.
Are you aware of the fact that you're in the machine?
No. I mean, you could do, I suppose, but the common thing is that you're just in the machine.
If I knew that I was in the machine while I was in there, then I definitely wouldn't. If I was plugged into the machine and knew beforehand that I would be unaware of the fact, I struggle to honestly say that I wouldn't.
Why is that?
Because he'd take the blue pill.
If I was aware of the fact that I was in it, then I would have guilt of the fact that I have a family outside that I should be looking after and should be present for, and I'm not. So even though I would be experiencing the pleasure, it would have its edge very much taken off by the fact that I know I have responsibilities that I'm not meeting. If I was plugged into it and I was then unaware of those responsibilities, there would certainly be a weaker moment in my life where I just say, fuck it, plug me in, and then forget all about them.
It's making that first decision as well to forget about them. It's going to be the killer. But presumably, if you're plugged into this machine, they would also be plugged into the machine as well. Is that right?
If that was the case, plug me in straight away.
Not according to the original thought experiment. It would just be you in the machine. There might be virtual representations of family members and that kind of thing, but you wouldn't be plugged in with your family members.
If I didn't have misses and kids, I'd probably say yes myself. But as I do, I couldn't leave them in the lurch.
Yeah, that's pretty much where I'm coming from. But I can't honestly say that there would never be a moment in my life where everything just seems so shit. And I just think, you know what? Fuck it.
Yeah, I'm with you there. We all have those weaker moments where we think, I just need a break. And if that opportunity came up at that time where you're at a proper low, and I'm obviously saying need a break, meaning a complete break, that you'd want to just jump into a machine and forget the world and just experience pleasure for the rest of your life.
I'd love to say that I'd be strong enough to not, but I mean, I'd love to be a liar, I suppose. I'm not.
Most people's intuitions cause them to say no. When performed on philosophy students and other various students around campuses, when they do surveys asking this question, a huge portion of them refuse to plug in.
Why?
Because there's a need for reality. I put that kind of bad. Say somebody's dream when they go in there is to become a rock star. It's a virtual version, and it's not the same as being an actual rock star.
They wouldn't know any different, though, would they? It's like being in the Matrix. You've got no way of telling that you're not actually in the real world.
Yeah, but that's the intuition that stops them plugging in to begin with. That even though they won't know it's not real, it's not real.
Has there ever been a similar survey saying, what if I told you you are in an experience machine and I can unplug you right now, but I cannot guarantee that the reality you will step out in, it works even remotely the same as ours?
That is the Matrix, isn't it?
Funnily enough, yes. I think it was the Brigard. I can't remember the exact author now. He did a survey that basically said, there's a knock on your door, and when you answer it, it's somebody that says, okay, I'm sorry to tell you this, but you've been stuck in an experimental machine for years. You're actually living a real life outside of this. We can't guarantee that you'll enjoy the life that you have when you unplug, but would you like to unplug and go back to the real world? And a great number of people said yes, they would like to unplug. Even when the question was tailored to be, when you're unplugged, you'll find yourself back in prison. This was just an experiment for rehabilitation. People said they would unplug.
I seem to be the exact opposite of people in both of these tests.
Oh, yeah. There's plenty of people that said that they would stay plugged in or that they would plug in. It's just that a higher amount decide to unplug or not plug in initially.
I think it's striving for normality, isn't it, almost, where you just want to, you don't want to be fooled, or you don't want to feel like you're being fooled. You just want to experience what reality is.
That's basically the situation. Climbing virtual Everest wouldn't have the same kind of satisfaction as climbing Everest.
Fair. I mean, I'm one of those people that wakes up from a dream and is desperate to get back into that dream because I was enjoying so much and it was much better than real life.
There's actually a fantastic Black Mirror episode on this, which White Rabbit, so I'm sure you guys are aware of it, where she's basically being terrorized in this kind of world, and she's just trying to run away from these people trying to gun her down. And then when she comes into reality, it finds out she's actually helped murder a child, and this is her punishment.
Yeah, it's like a theme park, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Like people go pay money to go there and witness the essentially human torture of this person that's committed obviously a terrible crime. But no doubt, if you say to her, right, do you want to experience the real world? Not saying that you'll enjoy it, but would you like to experience it? She'll definitely say yes. And then when she wakes up, it's not going to be a pretty picture for her either way.
Sorry, if you stop talking about that now, because I just had my things in my ears laughing at myself because I haven't seen that episode yet.
Oh, shit. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, and apologies to anybody else who's listening who hasn't watched it.
Spoiler alert. Right, you can cut that just before.
Just paste that a bit back.
It's a missed opportunity for Rick and Morty, too. I mean, they were actually in an experience machine at some point, and they didn't do anything with it.
They did. There was a arcade machine, wasn't there, where he lived a whole life.
Exactly. Nothing whatsoever.
But, yeah, back to the experience machine. It seems odd to me that people would rather have real suffering than simulated pleasure. Was there any study done where it actually took a measure of how good a life the people who answered were having?
No. Not that I've read, anyway. There might be one. I might look into that, actually, go through the library computer. The survey that was done was a narrowing of the question, because when prompted for further reasons for why they wouldn't plug in, people would say things like, well, the machine might break down, or technology's not good enough to do that, so I don't trust it.
That almost sounds like some of the modifiers that you get on the trolley problem. You give, look, you've got two choices, and they'll go, well, I'll do number three. Well, no, there's only two choices. Well, I would do this. I would jump in front of the trolley. Okay, well, that would mean you would die and the original person would die. So what's the point of doing that? You've got two choices. You cannot get in front of this trolley. I would find some way to put the brakes on. No, you don't have that as an option. You have two. I am going to modify this in any way that lets me not answer the question that you are asking.
Basically a politician.
Yeah, people aren't good with thought experiments. It's just, this is the parameters you are given. I don't like them. That can't happen. It's like, well, either answer the question or just shut the fuck up.
People aren't good with thought experiments because people generally aren't good at thinking.
Ooh, burn. And true.
The thing in this case is that they did answer the question. It's just that faulty intuitions led to an answer that they didn't give when those intuitions were taken care of in the question. The cleaner the question and the more of those intuitions that were taken care of, the more people said yes.
So they modify the question to say something like, in a hypothetical world where this machine works perfectly and cannot break, would you do it?
Yeah, basically. And the more that was narrowed down like that, the more people said yes, though a majority still said that they wouldn't plug in. But it is, like you were saying earlier, it is basically the Matrix and the idea behind the Matrix, would you unplug type thing.
You'll have to let me know if you find any study done where it actually includes quality of life data as well, because I think that would have quite a lot of sway in the percentage of people who say yes or no.
That is one of the common criticisms of the experience machine. Like, for example, somebody who was being beaten and raped every day would probably very quickly choose to go into the experience machine, regardless of what was happening to their body in the real world, as long as they didn't have to experience it.
I think that's a great one to come back to. If you do find anything, or if anyone of you guys find something on that, we can come back to it where we do our summary episode of the different moral theories. Is there anything else we need to cover off on hedonism tonight?
Not that I can think of. Yeah, these are basically just like summaries, aren't they?
Yep. Okay, well, that's the end of this chapter. You're currently listening to Fresh Air. We've just covered off hedonism. I'm Joe.
I'm Dave.
I'm Martin.
I'm Chris, and I'm not good at remembering to stop asking long questions.
And I'm Andy.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.